This episode of East Meets West is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/east. Welcome to East Meets West, episode 277. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And it is good to be back. Sorry, I was gone on vacation again.
Oh, how dare you, Tom? How dare you?
I was gone for CES, then I'm gone on vacation. But I'm pretty much back. I don't think I'm traveling again until, I don't
March.
Know. Well, March 17th, I'm going down for WonderCon. But that's just to LA, right?
Are you guys doing a panel there?
Yeah, I'm on a panel at WonderCon.
That's cool.
So that's exciting.
I was thinking about doing that, but
that's just a
one-day
thing. Like I fly down Saturday morning, I fly back Sunday morning. So that's not really like a trip.
But you're going to Anaheim. That's awesome.
Oh, right. I'm going to Anaheim and I'm staying at a Hilton. I need to get a Hilton honors number. I think I have one, actually. I don't stay at Hilton's very often.
I don't. I like hotels, but it's all a blur of generic queen size beds, towels, and showers.
I love staying in hotels. It's just a weird thing about me.
Okay.
I don't know why. I just do.
If I could, this would be actually kind of cool. You know, so one of the ideas that has come up recently, especially for moving, is that they put a giant kind of container in your front.
Those companies. They drive up with the container. It's lockable. You move everything into the container yourself. Then they bring the container to where you're moving, and then you unload it yourself. And it's supposedly cheaper than hiring movers.
I was thinking maybe you could do like an RV or a little space like that in a shipping container. And then, you know, whenever you want to take a vacation or something, they just bring it over there. I mean, granted, of course, you would have some distance limitations, but
I don't know.
I mean,
so you would travel inside the container?
No. You would travel separately, but this isn't for.
Oh, this would have like your own fixtures and
yeah,
your
so
own,
would have your own.
I see.
And then
that's actually
kind of
genius.
And it would be for a longer thing, something where you would need to be somewhere for like 3 months or four, you know, half a year, but don't necessarily need to, you know, rent a place or, you know, you don't want to get.
Now, would this be part of your home when it's not being used for travel?
It could very well be something that attaches to the side of your house and, you know,
an extension to your house that you then get to live in on vacation. You know, I kind of love that idea, although I'm not sure how practical it is for people. Obviously, you live in an apartment, it's not going to work. Even like the house I live in now, there really isn't a place to add a container size extension to it.
Well, the reason I bring it up is one of the things, for some reason, I was watching the show with the RVs and people in and traveling. It's like, I really like the idea of an RV. I just really don't like driving.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like getting.
But you're saying you'd have to drive there anyway.
Well, it would have to get there somehow, but, you know, I could.
Well, I guess the point is like, well, if you're going to drive yourself to wherever you're going, what's the point of having the container delivered separately? Why not just drive an RV?
I don't know. What if it's really difficult? Maybe you're working in the desert or something.
It's just easier to drive a sedan.
I was just thinking about it. It doesn't have to be a practical alternative to a Winnebago or.
Well, and granted, while you can live in your RV in your own property.
Some people do, especially when they have a domestic
dispute. But that's not something that's normal. It's not something that integrates well, I guess, is what I should say. Yeah.
The in-laws also go in the RV.
At the best, you park the RV in a garage and then it's in the house. But it's not really ideal, whereas I could see a shipping container being hooked up in such a way that it would integrate quite nicely with the house. But it's kind of disruptive to just rip part of the house off when you go on vacation. I guess you don't care because you're not home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, it also goes back to the whole idea of rethinking how houses are built. For the past 1,000 years, it's you put a foundation and you build up a structure, whether it be from bricks, wood, or whatever. And it's something that's not very modular. One of the ideas that have been flying around was to reuse, that have been kicking around in these circles, is to reuse shipping containers, like the ones you see on container ships bringing goods and cargoes, and you would reuse that as housing. One of the ideas was to stack it up and...
Well, it's being done.
It is being done, yeah. But can you imagine if you built a house that way out of multiple containers? So, like, it would be a four-container house.
Oh, so you've read Ready Player One.
No.
Oh. That's essentially the idea. Okay. In the slums around Oklahoma City, they're all built out of shipping containers.
But I mean, but not, it wouldn't be a slum. It would not be low scale. It would just be incredibly modular.
Well, the book, it's a slum because that's cheap. And so it ends up being a slum. And the thing is, modular homes is code word for trailer park. I mean, most current modular homes end up in trailer parks. Not all the time.
I think prefab homes are definitely considered.
Yeah, and prefab homes and stuff like that. So,
although the ones we stayed at Serafina's wedding, I have to admit, was pretty swank.
No, they're very nice. They can be very nice, but I think people they have a stigma of being, like, oh, that's for people who can't afford a real house, whether that's deserved or not.
I like the fact that it's not built into the earth.
But that's also bad. I mean, there's a reason you build a foundation. It's so the house is more stable.
Oh no, you build a foundation and you put the thing on top of it. It's not like
you rivet it to the.
Well, you don't really build. You don't really. I mean, you can, you just put it on the top. I mean,
what if it slides off?
It happens.
What holds it to the foundation?
Yeah. Well, what do you think happens during an earthquake with most of the houses in the Bay Area? Some of them shift off their foundation.
Some. You happens. Just said most and then some.
No, I didn't say.
Yes,
no,
during an earthquake, a house can shift off its foundation. Yeah. But during an earthquake, a house that's placed on a foundation is going to shift. There's no maybe about it if it's not attached.
I think it
You're
would be workable.
Crazy.
I'm not crazy. I think it would be.
You're telling me that you could just place a shipping container on a foundation and when the earthquake comes, it'll be fine.
It'll be fine. Yeah,
no.
Totally.
Even just like a general vibration over time is going to shift it off. It has to be attached in some way. Am I nuts in thinking that?
You just put some clamps on the side.
You're not serious.
Well, it's how is that any different than building a huge parking lot and putting a shipping container on that? It's just the foundation's a lot bigger.
What are you talking about, building a huge parking lot and putting a shipping container on it?
Well, no, I mean, it's just like build the foundation, you build it out like you would a small parking lot, and you're set. And then you could build out. I don't think there's any issue with it at all.
Oh my! Really? You seriously don't think there's any issue with it?
Other than plumbing, like putting all your
and if you have plumbing, you want the shipping container to not move over time.
Unless you have flexible hoses that go into a sit area.
Now I know you're not serious.
Oh, I'm telling you, it's a brilliant idea. Along with all my other money-making ideas.
Tell you what, you put Chairman Chang's Happy Fun Time Casino.
Happy Lucky Fun Time Casino in
shipping containers when you build it.
Hey, casinos in shipping containers.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Because when you back off the crazy talk, the idea of using shipping containers in ways like that, I think, is fantastic. You know, this sort of idea of data centers and shipping containers, etc. I think that's brilliant. I don't think easy as you just throw it on a slab of concrete.
This is what you do. On the foundation, you put metal posts, much like the studs you find on the top of a Lego brick, and then the shipping containers just slot straight in.
Well, so that was all I was saying, is you have to attach it to the foundation somehow.
Oh, there. You happy?
Now, is that going to make it hard to pull off?
Well, no, you just lift it up. It's not going to be any taller than maybe a foot tall at most.
All right. You think that'll be enough to stabilize it?
Yes.
It'd probably be enough in most cases. Although
I
still worry
a
little
hurricane,
bit.
Then you should probably bury the shipping container under the ground.
That's a good idea.
and then have like what do you call it in the Midwest where you have the basement double doors?
The storm cellar.
The storm cellar, yeah.
Well, there you go. You have two shipping containers.
Exactly, and then
your earthquake cellar.
You can like in the middle, it'll be like a boxcar, a railroad car. The middle would open up, and you could just kind of have this open.
Yeah, because I mean, we're talking earthquakes because we live in California, but hurricanes, tornadoes, there's all kinds of.
I think there's a future for prefab homes, and I think
it's got a stigma though. You got to get past. How do you get past that stigma?
I've always been curious about this. Is it a stigma only in North America? Or is it a stigma around the world?
Oh, I think it's probably a stigma around the world. I think it's a stigma caused by the enlargement of the middle class. In other words, when there isn't much choice, there's not much stigma. But once you start to move into the middle class and you're like, oh, I have nicer clothes and I have a semi-luxury car, all of a sudden you don't... Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Just thinking of what a semi-luxury car is.
Those mid-range cars that they're not quite Mercedes, but you know they've got voice control. I really think that there is an irrational rejection of anything from the class you're leaving because you see it as a step backwards, and I see that a lot. Public transportation is a great example. In lots of places, it's like, oh, well, I have to take the bus, so I know I'm not doing great. I'm going to have a car someday. You know, I'm going to drive myself. I'm going to get independent. That's not just a North American ideal. You see that in lots of areas of the world. Even if it's less attainable in certain economies, you know, when you get money, you want to leave the trappings of poverty behind and show that you moved out of it.
Well, I think part of it is also the convenience factor. It's you know, having your own automobile, rightly or wrongly, is seen as, well, I can do it at my convenience, and I'm not doing it according to something.
And it's a status symbol on top of that. So it's a dual prong. It's sort of like, yes, I have the leisure to go wherever I want, whenever I want, right? And there's a symbol of like, and I can afford to do it. And I can afford to do it in this lovely Honda.
I can afford to do a lot of things, but I have to think long term. Where's my?
Well, you do, but I'm just saying people generally don't.
You remember what I used to drive? That piece of crap Volvo station wagon.
You don't still drive that?
No, it finally stopped working. And got towed.
Yeah,
yeah. What did you want? I mean, the whole side was crushed in. For people who don't know, I used to drive a '86 blue Volvo station wagon. And the entire driver's side was kind of punched in because it got T-boned by a 16-year-old.
You know, I've been in your other car, your white car.
Oh, my Camry.
But I still imagine, whenever I think of you driving, I always think of you in the station wagon for some reason. I
love that car. It just didn't hold up after years and years of abuse.
I kind of had, well, that was, you know, you were driving that, and not too long after that, I was driving the 1981 Toyota Corona.
That was a pretty nice car. This is the thing that annoys me. Some of those older cars, and this goes beyond cars too, but because of the perceived value on it, or this, you know, the amount people are willing to pay, parts for that car, even though that car has been in production for like 20 plus years, were extremely expensive. Just to get like a new tail lens that was crushed in, they wanted like $270 for a used part, not a new one, a used part. And I was like, come on. I mean, I can get a new lens for my dad's truck for like $40 new.
It's all about demand. Not enough demand, price goes up.
Stupid Swedes. They should have
stupid supply demand graph. Having driven a 2002 Saturn for quite a while, and then a 2002 Toyota Prius, and several rental cars. There is a difference between less expensive cars, the way they drive, and more expensive cars. There is.
Yeah.
But it's not as much as they want you to think. There's sort of a, basically I would say like the difference between a Saturn and a Toyota Prius or even like a Corolla is there is a big difference. I'm talking about the Saturn SC1, by the way, not the SC2 for those who care. It drives better. The Corollas and Priuses drive better. And then when you go step up to like your Infinities and your Mercedes, those drive appreciably better than the Corollas. But really, I've only noticed about three classes amongst all these different cars in the maneuverability and the way they drive. There's subtleties that aficionados probably appreciate, but essentially, it's really not that much of a difference between the three. After a certain point, the luxury element becomes all of the little nifty add-ons, you know, the built-in GPS screen and the voice control and the heated seats and all of that.
The best luxury item I've ever encountered in a luxury automobile is climate-controlled seats. Seats that run air conditioning as well as heating through the seats, through little perforations.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, was the ultimate. Everything else is like, eh, like GPS... Yeah, I guess maybe, you know, memory
seats. It's handy, but yeah.
I'll be honest, I'd sooner ditch my power seat for just a standard, you know, manual because it's, for me, it's quicker to adjust when someone comes in.
Oh yeah, I don't like power seats. I feel like manual are perfectly easy. Unless I was mobility impaired, in which case then I think power seats.
If I was mobility impaired, I don't think anyone would be touching my car.
Would be touching your car?
Like the reason I have that issue is like, you know, I lend people my car and they adjust the seat.
Oh yeah.
And then
I have that issue for a different reason. I have a wife, and so we, you know, drive our cars, both of us, and when one of gets in after the other is driven, it's always adjusted.
You should have married someone your exact physical size.
There you go, kids. Learn from my mistakes.
Wouldn't that be kind of weird to kind of date a, you know, like basically be hitched to a female version of you?
Ugh, that's freaky. That's what that is. Hey, we got to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by audible.com. Of course, you know, they're the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They have now topped 100,000 downloadable titles. And they have, as you know, all types of literature, fiction, nonfiction, New York Times bestsellers. Listeners of this podcast get a free Audible audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook I would like to recommend is The Coldest War by Ian Tregillis. Now, this is the second in the series, although the series is such that they take place far enough apart from each other, you can actually read them out of order, and it's not going to confuse you. The interesting thing is The Coldest War by Ian Tregillis has been released on Audible before the print version. You cannot buy a print version of Ian Tregillis's Coldest War. You can only get it on audiobook. And I like the series because it's about World War II era and the Coldest War is Cold War era world politics, where one side has wizards and the other side has superheroes. And it's not as cheesy as that I just made it sound. It's not, you know, Captain America in a cape flying around. It's actually pretty gritty, like the Nazis developed the superheroes through genetic engineering. And the wizards are not like, oh, I'm in a pointy hat and I'm an old man who cast a spell. They're like freaky, otherworldly people that you have to, you can't really trust are always going to be on your side when you call in their powers. So it's a really, really good series. Check it out. You can try it out absolutely free and be the first one to read the book by going to audiblepodcast.com/east. That's the place to go to get your free audiobook, audiblepodcast.com/east. And we thank audio for existing, and we thank Audible for supporting East Meets West.
Oh. Cool. That book actually sounds really interesting. It's kind of reminds me a little bit of Red Star, which was a comic book series based on an alternate reality where the Soviet Union, as part of their military campaigns, possessed supernatural beings, warlocks and witches, who were harnessed for their abilities to power the weapons on these huge ships they call sky furnaces to attack their enemies. And what I really liked about it was how Well, one of the traits of the Soviet military thought was it was very scientific, very mathematical. Everything had a principle. Everything had a formula that you followed in order to execute the perfect attack plan. And the author Chris Gossett carries on the same tradition in that the spellcasters cast protocols. They have different formulas for enacting certain reactions. It was really interesting because I've never really seen magic kind of dovetail with a very kind of hard analytical wrapper around it, where, you know, everything had to be done in a specific manner. Everything was very, very, very laid out and spelt out. Which was kind of cool.
The Bitter Seeds does not spell out how the magic is done in that kind of detail, but it is definitely spelled out as something where you're essentially opening up access to some sort of interdimensional being, and they may be malevolent or they may not. But you basically do some pretty nasty stuff to get them to do your bidding, and then they'll do it. And the British use them against Nazi Germany to turn the tide of World War II. And then the Soviets, of course, you know, are in the war as in regular history. And I believe what happens, I haven't quite started the Coldest War yet, but I believe what happens is they come into possession of the genetic experiments of the supermen from the Nazis and start using them in the communist bloc. And so then the wizards are essentially U.S. allies, and the superheroes, the supermen, are basically communist bloc. Yeah. Weapons.
Kind of reminds me of Red Sun, the alternate telling of what happened to Superman if he landed in the Ukraine instead of
Kansas.
Yeah,
that it doesn't other than the fact that it's, you know, people with superpowers in a communist country, it's really nothing like Red Sun. I've read Red Sun on your recommendation, and it's great. I recommend it as well. That's Superman. The superheroes are more what you're talking about, where there's a very detailed explanation of how they become superheroes and get their powers. It's genetic experimentation. It's the exact kind of thing that I wouldn't be terribly surprised if there was the evidence that the Nazis were trying to do and just didn't succeed in reality. But in this book, they figure it out and they're able to get people who can turn into fire, and people who can see the future, and people who have incredible strength through genetic manipulation.
Well, sounds good. I think everyone should check it out if you're the least bit interested in things involving normal history and magic and superheroes.
Yeah, it's kind of an alternate history. If you're into alt history and magic, there's some sword, there's some laser.
Alt.history. Oh my God.
OMG. I miss newsgroups.
They were pretty cool. That's where I got a lot of my content, you know.
That was really my first main interaction with the internet. My first interaction with the internet was Gopher, but Gopher was more about document retrieval. And my first interactive experience was definitely newsgroups.
Yeah. I think the first big one I had was Prodigy. Like, but that wasn't even really the internet. That was just online.
And I didn't do that many BBSs. BBSs tend to be what folks a little younger than me had as their first interactive experience. But I was too young. I was too early with my Commodore 64 to really hit the BBS circuit. It kind of came after I moved on from that, and I never got a modem anyway. But by the time BBSs started to become popular, I was off already doing like harder core computer stuff and shell accounts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I went right into Gopher and Usenet.
Usenet was cool. But, it's spawned many crazy things online.
I used to post Subbrilliant News to Usenet.
Oh.
I can't find any of it in the Google archives. It didn't make the cut.
Yeah, the Google's a little limited when it comes to Usenet stuff. I remember what did we used to use at Tech TV? We actually had a Usenet account, and I used to access it all the time. But
was it day? It wasn't Deja News. It was before that. It was from that.
It's something that we actually paid for as part of our.
I sort of remember that now. I bet I have it on my old Tech TV laptop.
It was something Leo adamantly said that we needed. We need a Usenet account access.
Well, and that seems silly now, but back then I think we did. It was fading then, but it wasn't dead by any stretch.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of. I mean, that's where a lot of the first MP3s were being hosted. Weird files, freaky videos, and stuff like that.
Remember how long it would take you to download an MP3 from Usenet?
I remember when everything would fit onto a zip drive, and I was excited. It's like, oh my god, this is so cool! I can take it home, a full 100 megabytes. That's unheard of.
Jazz drives too.
Those things were
a pile of crap. Jazz drive war.
Those things so broke so quickly.
We had jazz drives at the radio station I worked at in college, and they were a mess. And we did tape backup of all of our systems.
We used to do that regularly at Tech TV. I remember that.
You know, we did tape backup of our traffic system, which is what we use to schedule all the ads. And our traffic person, the person in charge of all that, refused to move to the Mac. We bought Macs for all the other offices, sales office, programming office. Everybody got a Mac. But the traffic person refused to move off her PC. And she was doing command line, you know, DOS-based programs and running tape backups. And you know what? It never failed.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing you can say for a lot of the older stuff until they actually did fail.
Nothing fails until it fails. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. It's logical, isn't it?
Well, we should. I was going to say, we're not going to get any guests, it doesn't look like.
No.
So we should at least look at episode 276 from a couple weeks ago and see if we have any. Do we not have any comments? No, we have five comments. They're just not loading for me. But there we go.
Wait a minute. Is that right? 276, right?
Yeah.
From
January 25th.
Yep, five comments.
I loved the talk about education, says Lou Page. I am personally a former college dropout who found a job that reimburses me to go back to school. I have found that most local schools I looked at, including the one I'm enrolled at, have a ridiculous amount of liberal classes I am required to take that have nothing to do with my major. I've been back to school for over a year, and in that time, I've only taken one class pertaining to business. While I do understand the need to take curriculum to expand my mind, it really feels like the school is expanding requirements just to pad their pocketbooks. On top of the four or five generic art, history, culture classes that are mandatory, I have to take six more free electives of my choice, two of which need to be world culture-based. I know that the school wants to make more creative and cultured. I appreciate that. But at about $1,200 a class plus books, it is expensive. I need 24 classes for my associate's degree, and only six or so are related to my major. Really? Come on. Once that is done, my bachelor's degree requires about 16 more classes, and about six of those relate only to my major, too. I don't mean to sound lazy or cheap, but for a married working class stiff, it seems like a losing battle that gives the school all the power. It doesn't help either that most of my professors have a second or third job. Where is the money going if they don't get it?
I have no idea. I've actually never worked in a school. I've been at school. I've gone to classes. I do remember actually many of my instructors, both at community college, JC, and state, actually had outside jobs. Like when I had my BECA major in state, I would say at least half of my instructors were still working in their field. In fact, one of them was Marty Gonzalez, the guy from Cron Channel 4. He actually taught a TV journalism class at State, and a few of my other ones still regularly produced, you know, commercials or produced albums. They were in the audio production industry. So in that case, I actually preferred that because it gave me the sense that at least these instructors knew enough about the current situation of the industry to give an accurate assessment to the student by saying, well, you know, this is what you're learning right now. This is how it's going to be applied because this is what I'm doing. you know, when I'm not here at school, this is when I, you know, when I'm cutting albums or cutting tracks for various artists, this is what we're using. This is what they demand. This is what they want. And it, I think it's very helpful. I don't know if that applies to different majors like business like Lou Page, but I think it's kind of cool as long as that outside job that they do is related to what they teach.
I think that the value of your education is probably worth more than $1,200 a class. In some ways, that's a bargain. That doesn't mean that it's any more affordable, though. $1,200 a class is a lot. That's a very expensive school. In fact, I know that schools around here in the community college are much less than that. They're more in the $500 a class range. So that is pretty pricey where you are, and that just may be the nature of the place you live in. I don't know. I would say, though, that I feel what Lou is saying, where it's like, hey, you know what? I want to get a business degree, and here I am spending a lot of money on a bunch of classes that aren't getting me a business degree. They just seem like fluff. On the other end of that, though, I think that this idea of vocational school is very dangerous, because we talk all the time on East Meets West about the need for critical thinking. And the way you get people to think critically and be able to think for themselves is to teach them more than just a vocation. You teach them about philosophy. You teach them about literature. You expose them to different ways of thinking. And so to reconcile what I think Lou is saying, which is absolutely understandable, and my thinking, I think the problem is the colleges aren't trying to design a program that actually has the goal of teaching you a broader set of skills. They are lazy. And in, you know, 100 years ago, maybe professors really were designing a curriculum that they thought would give you a broad, well-rounded education. But now they just throw these electives at you and they don't make any sense. And so here you are like, I got to take some world culture and I got to take some art history. And how is this related? That's the problem. If they were saying, okay, you're going to take these 6 business classes, and we're going to have you take these 6 other classes. And these 6 other classes are designed to give you a better, well-rounded experience. But what kind of business are you going into? Maybe you're thinking about going into a business about import-export, right? And so are you interested in India? Let's have you take some Indian history and maybe some Asian culture classes. And therefore, you're getting a more well-rounded education, but it's also related to your business interests, right? I mean, that's the kind of guidance that you should get and is incredibly rare in college.
I think part of it is, essentially what he's required to take is in the majority of the classes he takes. For example, his electives seem to count for more than half.
Well, and that's not actually that unusual in a liberal arts degree. You have a core, you have a major, and the major is a quarter of your classes, and everything else is electives and general ed requirements.
I got all my requirements out of the way actually in JC, because it was so much cheaper to do that way, which, you know, I don't know if it still works the same way, at least in California.
You know what? I'm thinking of junior college, community college. He's saying $1,200. He must be taking classes, night classes at an actual university, like a higher quality university. That's my guess. I mean, he's still getting talking about getting an associate's degree, though. So,
yeah, it could very well be an online class.
Maybe.
But I mean, you know, I think both Tom and Lou bring up very valid points, and it's one of those, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's nice to be able to broaden out the view, but especially when it's so expensive and
I think the problem is that the education system is trying to you know, make it simple, to process as many humans through the factory. And that education shouldn't be a factory. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Shall we get down to some other commentary?
Yeah, well, there's really not that many other. Yeah. I mean, STF says he thinks education wastes a lot of time preparing students for nothing in particular, and specialized paths carry a stigma socially and political. That's kind of addressed by what we were just talking about. Francis says, ditto, well done. At the end, Roger will have his award of being right.
I like that.
Oh, that's responding to SDF saying, I think Colleen's troll nature is a good foil to Roger's contrarian nature, is a good foil to Tom's mediating nature. It's refreshing to hear Colleen call Roger on his shyat.
I have no idea what he's referring
people
to.
Like people like conflict. They like controversy. And
Colleen
had a little
conflict.
Friendly controversy. So
SDF, come online. I'll give you some conflict right now.
But yeah, and then Chustar says, you know, he can attest to, as an international student graduating the U.S., how horrifying the process is to try to stay in the U.S. to work. He also says some nice things about San Jose State. And then Bobo Jones didn't seem to like Colleen very much. So
yes, well,
that's it for the comments.
Yeah. Well, it was a good talk, and I think Lou brought in a lot.
Yeah, thanks for that, Lou. That's good perspective. Good to have. And thanks everybody for making your comments known. Sabrilliant.com/EMW. That's it for this episode of the show. Big thanks to Scott Johnson and the Frog Pants Network for letting Woo-hoo. Us on and being a part of the whole thing. Are you going to try to make it out to Nerdtacular, Roger?
What's the date for that?
I think it's like June 13th.
I will try. I'm trying to.
I could be wrong. Maybe it's June 23rd.
We're doing. See, I'm trying to figure out when E3 is because we might be doing that. So I don't know if that might conflict.
Isn't E3 in like May? No,
I thought it was in June.
Early, but I think it's in early June. Hold on, I could tell you when the nerds.
Nerdtacular
are coming. If I can get to my calendar. Yeah, I think it's June 23rd.
Okay.
Nerdtacular, right. There it is.
I will put it on
it's
my list.
Saturday. All right, thanks everybody for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.